Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Drama unfolds as we tell the story of Thomas à Becket. And sharing the horrors of Roman habits as we take you on an exclusive tour of the Colosseum with our lover of all things Latin. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. With last week's episode of The Vatican Centuries, our journey back in time to rediscover some of the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican throughout the centuries came to an end. So today we begin a new series of programmes by the title of Witness, focusing on some of our best known martyrs. To explain the title, the word martyr comes from the Greek martus, meaning witness. From this series of programmes, we've chosen to focus in a special way on the martyrs from England, in an effort to lead up to Pope Benedict XVI's forthcoming apostolic visit there next September. Among the figures Jill will be looking at in this series are, to begin with, Thomas à Becket. But I won't tell you too much about him, as you can hear all about him in a few moments. In order of broadcast, you'll be finding out about the Carthusian martyrs, the first of the English Reformation. They're three Carthusian priors who were hanged, drawn and quartered at Tyburn in 1535 for denying the king's supremacy over the church. Then Thomas More, the Chancellor of England, beheaded on Tower Hill in July of 1535 for refusing to sign the Act of Succession, which repudiated the Pope's jurisdiction. Following More, Jill will be taking a look at an English Jesuit, Edmund Campion, who was hanged, drawn and quartered at Tyburn in 1581. A scholar and a gentleman, Campion typified the dedicated Catholic priest of penal times, always in danger, knowing that sooner or later betrayal and martyrdom were inevitable. Next in line, a Yorkshire woman, Margaret Clivero, a wife and mother who was crushed to death for harbouring priests and helping the Catholic cause. One of the more outstanding witnesses of the numerous lay women who paid with their lives for the hospitality offered to fugitive priests. Finally, another Jesuit, Robert Savile, an Elizabethan poet hanged, drawn and quartered in Tyburn in 1595. So, six English martyrs for this series in which Jill Bevilacqua attempts to answer a number of questions linked to martyrdom. Beginning with, what is a martyr and what makes him? Is it necessary to shed one's blood, to give one's life in order to qualify as a martyr? Is martyrdom a matter of choice, or is it written down from the beginning? Do those who become martyrs receive a warning from God beforehand? Well, let's begin then with the first in this dramatic series, which focuses on the figure of Thomas à Becket, famously stabbed to death in his cathedral in December 1170.
On a dark December afternoon, four knights of the court of Henry II rode into Canterbury in search of the Archbishop, Thomas à Becket. They left him dead in the blackness of his own cathedral, and the common people came to dip their hands in his blood. Within hours, miracles were performed in his name, and 2 years later, he was proclaimed a saint and martyr of the church.
The quarrel between Thomas of Canterbury and his king is one of the most famous in English history, due mainly to the powerful personalities of the two men, who from being bosom friends became arch enemies, to the point that Henry wished Thomas dead, a wish uttered in anger and deeply regretted when it was granted.
Thomas Becket was born in London in 1118, son of a Norman merchant. As a young man, he worked in the household of Theobald, Archbishop of Canterbury, accompanying him to important European centres and taking time off to study canon law. He held several ecclesiastical posts, and then, in 1154, was appointed Archdeacon of Canterbury.
Thomas has been described by contemporaries as tall and spare, with dark hair and a pale face that flushed in excitement. Henry was obviously impressed by him, for he made him Chancellor of England in the following year. The two men understood each other so well, they were said to be of one heart and mind. So that when Archbishop Theobald died in 1161, Henry saw it as a golden opportunity to subjugate church to state by putting his own man in office.
But he had not reckoned on his friend's reaction. Thomas must have foreseen the dilemmas such an appointment would produce, for he waited a year before accepting the post. And when he did, from being, in his own words, a proud, vain man, a feeder of birds and follower of hounds, he was transformed into a shepherd of sheep.
He opposed the encroachments of the king on the liberties of the clergy and the rights of the church. When Henry ordered him to appear before the great council to explain himself, Thomas refused, denying the authority of the king and placing himself under the protection of the Pope and of God. He fled to France and stayed in exile for 6 years.
Then, in 1170, the king and Becket met in Fretteval, Touraine, and there was a public reconciliation, or so it seemed. Both men, in principle at least, put their claims on one side. The king, for his part, made no mention of his rights and customs. What was more, he guaranteed the archbishop a safe return home and full possession of his see, without demanding any oath of loyalty.
Henry and Thomas met once more later in the year, this time at Chaumont. They would not meet again. Thomas must have had a presentiment, for when they said farewell, he turned to the king with these words.
My lord, my heart tells me that I part from you as one whom you shall see no more in this life.
Do you hold me as a traitor?
That be far from thee, my lord. Adieu.
Adieu, Thomas. Thomas.
And so, to England. Whether to peace or destruction, I know not. God has decreed what fate awaits me.
Thomas was gone, galloping towards his destiny on the other side of the Channel. He was not fooled by the king's acquiescent manner. The sooner he was back in Canterbury, the better. Once there, he would appeal to the Pope for unlimited powers of excommunication. That way, he could discipline his ecclesiastical forces. The more potent and fierce the prince is, he wrote, the stronger stick and harder chain is needed to bind him and keep him in order.
The Archbishop was given an ecstatic welcome home. In London, he rode through the streets in triumph, scattering alms to the cheering crowds. In Canterbury, he was received by his monks as an angel of God. But when he preached in the cathedral, he spoke strange words. I am come to die among you. In this church, there are martyrs, and God will soon increase their number.
We do not think of a martyr simply as a good Christian who has been killed because he is a Christian. For that would be solely to mourn. We do not think of him simply as a good Christian who has been elevated to the company of the saints. For that would be simply to rejoice. And neither our mourning nor our rejoicing is as the world's is. A Christian martyrdom is never an accident. For saints are not made by accident. Still less is a Christian martyrdom the effect of a man's will to become a saint. As a man, by willing and contriving, may become a ruler of men. A martyrdom is always the design of God, for his love of men, to warn them and to lead them, to bring them back to his ways. It is never the design of man. For the true martyr is he who has become the instrument of God, who has lost his will in the will of God, and who no longer desires anything for himself, not even the glory of being a martyr.
But in Becket's absence, the king had seen fit to have his young son crowned by the Archbishop of York. Becket was deeply offended and promptly excommunicated all the clergy who had taken part in the ceremony. They travelled en masse to the king, who was in Normandy, and declared that the Archbishop was ready to tear the crown from the young king's head. This sent Henry into a fury, and surrounded by his knights and nobles, he made the celebrated declaration.
What a pack of fools and cowards I have nourished in my house, that not one of them will avenge me of this turbulent priest.
The king's outburst had its effect immediately. The challenge was taken up. Four knights looked at each other and came to a quick decision. There was no time to lose. They left the court in secret and travelled hotfoot to the coast. Once across the channel, they called for horses and rode fast to Canterbury.
It was the time for Vespers. Thomas the Archbishop followed the monk carrying his crozier through the cloister, slowly, as in processional. He heard the chanting of the monks come from the choir. The storm had come into the cloister. Rain slanted in. A wind scooped down beneath the eaves and wet their faces and blew their garments wildly in the dark. The chanting faded and then rose again. Voices behind them and the splintering of wood. The church was dark. Only the altar lights glowed in the choir, far away. Thomas crossed the transept and started up the steps to the altar. Then, suddenly behind him, he heard heavy running, and turning, he saw them, and the glint of their mail. The clerks had fled. The monks had left their service. And there was silence in the wavering dark. Thomas came back down the steps towards them, and facing them, he put his back against the pillar and stood still. They closed in towards him, groping in the dark. One of them took his sword in hand and crossed the nave towards the south transept to keep the people back. The three came on. And Thomas saw the bulk of shoulders in the dark, a glimmer on the mail, the pointed helmets and the blur of white, their faces cloven by the nasal guards. They came on crouching, arms held wide. Then the first sprang at him, clutching the pallium round his neck, while another reached for his body to lift him off his feet. A sword swung, arched and whistled in the darkness, grazing Thomas's head, knocking his cap off, leaving the tonsure bare. A shout and another sword descended, glanced along the crozier, and Thomas stood wounded, blood on his face. This was his moment. He had chosen it, not Henry. And he died for God alone, no other way. He crossed his hands and bowed his wounded head. Two more blows and Thomas was on his knees, and a third struck him as he fell, so savage that the iron sword broke off against the stones. The men stood back, panting, as their leader looked down at the body and nudged it with his foot. He put his heel upon the neck and thrust his sword point into the broken skull. And swaggering, he walked away.
When the monks lifted up the corpse, they cried out, for underneath it, now revealed where it had been hidden by the fur-lined robe, there lay the broken blade, all blood-stained, of a sword. They lifted the body and went up the steps to the choir, leaving the broken sword, the costly fur-lined cloak, the folded pallium, behind them on the bloody stones. They brought candles and placed him before the altar. Then their voices rose in lamentation for the dead, in praise of this new martyr of the church.
Henry was shattered by Thomas's death. He swore on the Gospels he had not desired it. He made a solemn oath of perpetual obedience to Rome. He made pilgrimages to Thomas's shrine and did public penance. And Becket's sacrifice was not in vain. Until the Reformation, the Church retained the system of ecclesiastical courts independent of the royal authority, and the right of appeal to Rome, two of the major points upon which Becket had defied the king.
But the enigma of Thomas Becket remains. What exactly happened to him when he became Archbishop of Canterbury? Was it simply a question of higher loyalties? Or did he experience something akin to an evangelical conversion, recognizing no master but God? The centuries have not clarified matters, and probably we shall never know.
And our thanks there go to Jill Bevilacqua for the first in this series she's written and presented. Thanks too to Sean Patrick Lovett, who's produced it. Also, if you enjoyed it, be sure to tune in at this same time next week to be introduced, this time, to the Carthusian martyrs. And now back to Rome for a monument there's been plenty of spilt ink over. It's Rome's most famous landmark, the Colosseum. Our guide to it, exceptionally our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster.
The original was like the biggest thing that was left from Roman times. What we see here is has half disappeared. The two outer walls you see are broken off right in front of us.
There are three levels of arches right in front of us.
Three walls in and three levels up.
They have columns of the three different orders, the Doric, the Ionic, and the Corinthian up on top. And then there's a fourth level, which we can't actually see except for a little bit from here.
That's the scaffolding. That was added by Titus, like some bleachers up there for standing spectators. Maybe for people just interested in stories, most people don't know where the idea of Colosseum comes from. And right across from us to the left over there where you see those trees, where the people are sitting there, there's a square that was put up by the Italian archaeologists. Well, that's the basis or the foundation of a colossal statue of Nero.
So that's where the Colosseum got its name.
So the fact is, where the Colosseum is today was an artificial lake inside or around the house, in front of the house of Nero. And he had this massive statue, which was perhaps as tall as the Colosseum is today, built in his honor. And so that stood there for several hundred years. And the emperors used to change the head, but keep the body and just change the head as they came and went. So it was this colossal statue, because you see
from Colossal Colosseum.
It was the Colossus of Nero, and therefore what was next to the Colossus of Nero was the Colosseum. But you see the Latin inscription right in front of us, Pius IX there, is Amphitheatrum Flavium. The Flavian Amphitheater, that's the technical name. Because the father and the two sons, Vespasian, Titus, well, Domitian a little later, the dynasty of the three Flavian emperors are responsible, and they're responsible for the Colosseum.
Why did they build it? I know that there are all kinds of legends connected to the Colosseum.
Well, one of the ideas, of course, even Julius Caesar had the idea of a Colosseum like this. Augustus had plans for it, but he never finished it. So there were ideas in the Roman mind to have a theater for the people, because there was really no one theater. Under the influence of Hollywood, you have the impression that Nero and all these other guys had games in the Colosseum. Of course, the Colosseum came after Nero. So they had portable theaters, or they used to have gladiatorial matches out in the streets in a certain sense.
So all the wild beasts and animals they talk about.
That started with the Colosseum, really. And they said it took 3 months to dedicate this Colosseum. About 3,000 different animals were killed around here. Rhinoceroses, all that other stuff, lions and elephants and stuff from North Africa. That's why North Africa doesn't have any animals today, because the Romans cleared the whole thing out.
But they brought them along in ships.
Oh, yeah, they right in here. For this dedication, we have a famous Latin poet, Martial, Martialis, who describes the games used for the celebration, some horrible things. When we go here with the students, I tell them the Colosseum is a monument to Roman architecture, but it's not a monument to Roman civilization.
And to Christianity?
No, neither. I'll tell you why. Because what went on there was really no credit to anyone. Gory, terrible games.
What happened here was a disgrace.
Well, yeah, because the Romans were very crude, you know. I mean, I love Latin, it's my whole life. But I mean, their culture was very crude. The Greeks had, you know, the fine games, you know, the Olympic games, light and races. What the Romans thought was pleasurable or delightful was really a disgrace. I mean, the more blood and the more horror went on, the more the people were delighted. If you read some of the stuff, even Martial's poems, about what went on, they thought it was a funny thing. For example, they would have a pregnant pig come out in the middle and kind of drive the pig so crazy that she would give birth out on the... And they thought, the Romans thought, this was a sign of fertility and a sign of the grace of the gods. And of course, you know, the different animals and stuff. And they said at one point that the elephants would kneel down in front of the emperor almost like crying, because they kind of knew what was happening to them, and they were being tormented by these things, these gladiators and the picadores. You'd have to do something like the bullfights today, got it? And they would train the elephants, and it was a terrible thing. On one occasion, the people stood up and booed the emperor because the elephants started crying. I mean, this whole the whole thing that went on here was really kind of awful. It goes against everything we think is kind of decent today, except maybe wrestling or something like that.
It goes against everything Christian.
Well, yeah, yeah. So every kind of decency today. I mean, what they thought was funny and pleasurable was just terrible. It was horrible, that's all. See, the place is beautiful, but what went on is bad.
Father, I can see there's a cross just opposite here. Why is there a cross on what could be a pagan amphitheater?
Well, yeah, I can see the Latin inscription here. It says, this is Pius IX, a very nice thing in 1852. Yeah, that's right. He says, this amphitheater dedicated to the gods by impious religion, and he says, and reborn from this bad superstition by the blood of the martyrs. And so the idea was with the Christians, they still thought that there were these masses of Christian martyrs here who reconsecrated the Colosseum to the true God after it had been used for false gods for so many centuries. So that's written all in Latin. If people understand Latin, you're going to understand. I can read this from here. In the fourth line, it says it was reborn by the blood of the martyrs. So kind of transferred. So the Christians came along and said, okay, this is our place now.
Is that why the Pope today leads the Stations of the Cross on Good Friday here?
One of the reasons. You have to understand also that until the Italians took over things in the 1890s, 1900 here, you had a whole city inside here. St. Philip Neri started Stations of the Cross in the Colosseum. There were two churches, two chapels in the Colosseum dedicated to the martyrs. All that stuff was torn out. So way before this present Pope came around, the Colosseum had churches and had the Way of the Cross inside.
Actually had churches inside.
Well, there were two chapels on both sides. That was all demolished. Who's another famous? Laboré. He, like the poor man who lived in Rome here, he lived inside here.
The Frenchman.
Yes, exactly. And so, and as I say, Philip Neri set up a Station of the Cross inside. So this goes way back to the 1500s, the tradition of the Station of the Cross in the Colosseum. You know, the order.
It was very helpful to pilgrims.
Oh, yes. The famous man, and with the poor and everything else, he was a pastor, you know, at St. John of the Florentines, right at the bridge there that goes over to the tunnel to the Vatican. He was the pastor over there for about 12, 13 years. And was really an outstanding man as the shepherd of people. And so he started all kinds of things here.
Hospices for the pilgrims.
Yes, exactly. At a hospice in Trastevere, Philip Neri. And then he moved over to the oratory, Santa Maria Nuova, Chiesa Nuova today. And anyway, and so he started all these different devotions and everything else. A very interesting man.
And heartfelt thanks there to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster, for taking us on this exclusive tour of the Colosseum. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.